Hello, and welcome to Level Zero. This is the show that meticulously researches a topic and then dives into that topic in a way that's fun and accessible. I'm Greg Griffith.
And I'm Preston Wilkie.
And on this episode, the history of...
Dig it up!
Whoa, dig it down a notch, buddy. Let's go. Hey, Preston.
Hey, Greg.
So, I've been thinking a lot lately.
Okay, that's not good.
I've been thinking a lot about how we got here.
Right, like how we got here to the recording studio.
No, okay, I meant how we got here in terms of video games.
Yeah. Ninth generation, we've got the Xbox Series X, we've got the PlayStation 5.
I've been thinking about how we got here in terms of the way the landscape of video games are and the way that consumers of video games are behaving, specifically how everyone is kind of at each other's throats all the time.
So the console wars, I believe, right, is what you're talking about.
Right. And not just console wars, but at the end of the day, how everybody kind of seems like they always have to pick a side. If you enjoy video games, you must pick a side. Enjoy only one side and always talk about how the other side is bad.
Right. And I think that does, we find that in genre talk. We find that in, console wars. It's kind of a little bit of everywhere.
Right. And it's ridiculous because, I mean, if you talk about movies or music, you don't have to pick a side. You just enjoy what you enjoy. Right.
Yeah. Although, is Scorsese correct? You know what? Never mind. We're just going to move past that one.
No, I've been thinking, though, that's how it is now. Gamers are kind of always at each other's throats. You know, oh, I like Xbox. I like PlayStation. Oh, Nintendo's over here doing whatever. You know, always providing commentary. But I've been thinking about, why is it like this?
Well, why is it like this? It sounds to me like you may have an answer.
I think I've got it figured out, Preston. What it all comes down to is it all comes down to history. Specifically, history of video games about 30 years ago.
Okay, so was this another four-part series on something?
Okay, no, it's not going to be a four-part series. What it came down to is I've been doing research on the history of Sega.
Ah, Sega. Nice.
Right.
And so how does that connect back to our console? Oh, it's because they lost, right?
Well,
they lost the consoles.
Okay, I feel like it more comes down to what it took for Sega to get to the top and what exactly happened during that process.
Yeah, so they seem to really like hit their peak in the 90s, so you probably grew up with them a lot, right?
Okay, actually, no, I was not a Sega kid at all. I was firmly on the Nintendo side. As a kid, I didn't even know I was picking a side. I just happened to enjoy that product. But how about you? Are you on the Sega side growing up?
I would agree with that sort of statement. I had no idea I was on the Sega side. It was my parents had enough for one console, and my brother wanted the sports console. So we got the sports console. And so I had a lot of Sega stuff growing up, but I would have never known that there was this argument between Sega or Sony or Nintendo at the time.
Yeah. Definitely not. But it's interesting because Sega's history is actually really long, really convoluted, and I just happened to stumble upon the whole console wars aspect of it.
Oh, really? Okay. So there's going to be a lot more to this than just like what happened in the 90s, right? Because it's not all localized there.
Exactly. You got to kind of have to understand the whole story before you even can get into that side. And when doing this research, I had to enlist a little bit of help to kind of make sure that I had it all right and could tell the whole story.
So you got the blue blur himself?
No, I was not actually able to get a hold of Sonic the Hedgehog. I left him a couple of voicemails. I mean, Mario gave me his number. I assumed I'd be able to talk to him. No, I was not able to get a hold of him for this episode, though.
It's good that Mario and him still stay in contact, but that's a bummer.
Yeah, they just did the Olympics together, so they were, you know.
Oh, that's true.
They were kind of on pretty good terms. But anyways, I ended up enlisting the help of someone else that is an expert on all things Sega history.
You're
just going to have to find out who that someone is.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. So, without further...
Then I don't want to wait any longer. Let's go.
No, Preston, this, I say, let's go. I say, all right. So without further ado, let's go.
Let's go. Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. It's ruined now. Sega. Even if you know very little about video games, there's a very good chance that you know the brand. Going hand-in-hand with Sonic the Hedgehog, it's one of the most recognizable names in all of video games. But how much do you know about the company and its origins?
A lot of people, when they think Sega, they think of Sega as a Japanese company, which it is today. But it didn't start out that way, right?
That's Ken Horowitz, a man who has dedicated a lot of time to... You know what? I'm just going to let him introduce himself.
My name's Ken Horowitz. I teach college research and English in Puerto Rico, and I run the website Sega16.com, which has been documenting Sega's hardware history for 17 years. I also write and research about video game history. I've written 3 books so far. Over the last 17 years, I've done over 500 articles for the website, including 120 interviews.
Ken Horowitz is not only a mega fan of all things Sega, but someone who's dedicated nearly 2 decades to researching Sega's history with a very specific interest in game development, writing, interviewing, and preserving the stories behind the companies and the games.
I interviewed Joe Miller, who was Sega of America's vice president of research and development. He succeeded Ken Balthaser. Joe Miller, I interviewed him. As far as I know, that's the only interview he did specifically about his time at Sega. And a year later, he died of stomach cancer. I interviewed Michael Knox, who's the head of Park Place Productions that did the Genesis version of Joe Montana Football. And he died of cancer shortly after that. These people are gone. You won't be able to speak to them again. And to have their own words, their own voice telling these stories is something that I think really needs to be preserved. And that's why I want to eventually take all my interview audio raw recordings and donate them to like the Strong Museum in New York.
Ken's research has been huge for the world of video game history and video game research. And I think it's fair to call him an expert on all things Sega history. So with his help, let's dive in. Sega's origins can be traced all the way back to the 1930s. Yes, the Great Depression, long before arcades and video games. Irving Bromberg, an American immigrant, had a business where he would buy and sell Bally pinball machines and other coin-operated machines across the United States. While he was still in high school, his son Martin would help him sell those machines as well. Once he graduated high school, Martin jumped feet-first into the business with his father. And in 1940, Martin would expand the business by forming a partnership called Standard Games, which would operate out of Honolulu, Hawaii, and sell and operate slot machines and other coin-op machines to American military bases, mainly the nearby Pearl Harbor. Then in 1941, the war came. Martin was laser-focused on becoming a successful businessman like his father, and he managed to get himself placed on the inactive duty list through shipyard assignments in Pearl Harbor, and this allowed Martin to continue working on his Standard Games business. Martin would eventually change his last name from Bromberg to Bromley. After the war, they sold off Standard Games and started a new company called Service Games. And that is a name to remember, Service Games. Still buying and selling coin-op machines, mainly slot machines, from the now closing military bases. Eventually, Martin Bromley and Irving Bromberg would expand internationally and sell their coin-op machines to the American military installations around the world. In 1951, they sent company salesman Richard Stewart along with coin-op mechanic Raymond Lemaire to Japan to set up shop for the international business. With the U.S. occupation of Japan after World War II, Bromley and Bromberg saw an opportunity for expansion, bringing coin-op machines into that country and selling them to the U.S. military bases on the island. Eventually, they would expand outside the military bases, and slowly the coin-op market began expanding into Japan itself. And Service Games was not the only game in town. Another American veteran, David Rosen, who served in the Air Force during the Korean War, would also start up a coin-operated business in Japan. You see, during his time in the Air Force, Rosen found both an admiration for the country of Japan along with a business opportunity. Since the war, Japan's economy was really struggling, but David Rosen saw a way to help. Every citizen in Japan at the time required a photo ID. So David Rosen came up with the idea of importing coin-operated photo booths from the US, which allowed Japanese citizens to get photos of themselves much faster and much cheaper than before. And eventually, competition for the photo booths would set in, so Rosen began buying other coin-operated amusement machines from the US and selling them in Japan to huge success. And just like that, his company, Rosen Enterprises, became one of the largest coin-operated companies in Japan. So you had Martin Bromley and Service Games, and then you had David Rosen and Rosen Enterprises all operating in Japan selling coin-operated machines. And these coin-operated machines varied from slot machines to photo booths to jukeboxes. Anything that you could put a coin in and it would do something, there's a good chance that David Rosen and Martin Bromley were selling these with their businesses. And despite a fair amount of success, David Rosen soon saw his position in the coin-op market slipping, so he sought a merger with Martin Bromley's business to ensure the business's future, which finally brings us to Sega. In 1965, Martin Bromley's business, which formerly was known as Service Games and then went through a couple of name changes, acquired Rosen Enterprises, and they formed Sega Enterprises. Sega, from the name Service Games, taking the first two letters of service and the first two letters of games, and Enterprises from Rosen Enterprises. And David Rosen was named CEO of this new company, while Richard Stewart would lead as president and Martin Bromley would sit on the board. And David Rosen was a very savvy businessman. He was never satisfied with the same, so he pushed for innovation. And this would become the theme of Sega for many, many years to come, still to this day. They wouldn't just import the same old machines from America and sell them to Japan. Instead, Rosen wanted to put out machines that the public had never seen before. They created and licensed aptly named electromechanical machines like basketball and punching bag in 1966 and 67, and a groundbreaking machine called Periscope. A massive cabinet featuring moving plastic ships on this fake ocean with bright blinking lights and loud sound effects. Players would look through an actual periscope and fire torpedoes in an attempt to hit the ship. And it was one of the very first coin-operated machines to ever cost one quarter, 25 cents. And despite this very high cost at that time, and the fact that there were only moving blinking lights representing the shooting torpedoes, Periscope was a massive hit, causing long lines and often bringing in upwards of $100 a day, even when there wasn't any kind of big event going on. It was so successful that David Rosen decided to flip Sega's entire business model on its head. They would create a smaller version of Periscope in Japan and ship it internationally.
They had been working with other people's machines, and Rosen wanted Sega to make its own machines. But the thing was, is like, how do you do that without, you know, pissing off U.S. distributors, because you don't want to become competition for the very people whose machines you're importing.
Soon, Sega was churning out several brand new games per year in Japan and shipping them to the U.S. By the late 60s and early 70s, business was really good for Sega, but it wouldn't stagnate for very long. You see, the 70s would bring about a technological shift that would change Sega's business forever. Video games. The change came in 1972 when a brand new company called Atari developed a video electronic game called Pong.
By 1973, you know, Pong changes everything. You know, now it's video. And so they have to get in on that. And also, Pong was just an insanely popular game at the time.
Its simplistic design and widely appealing gameplay loop led to a breakthrough hit in the coin-op space. And Sega was very quick to notice. They wanted to try to make a very similar type of machine. They wanted to try video games. So how did they get started?
Okay, well, they started with Pongtron, which was basically a Pong clone. The same way a lot of companies, I mean, Nintendo copied Pong, Sega copied Pong. I think Romstar copied Pong. Romstar, was it? Or Taito. It's like back then, you know, this is a new industry. So, you know, the copyright law is very, very fuzzy, if it's there at all.
Sega was so quick to react to the game's popularity that it was actually able to create and release Pongtron in Japan before Atari was even able to formally release Pong in that country. And although it was a clone of Pong, this would mark the first time that Sega ever used a CRT TV in one of its coin-op machines, making it a standout from the rest of Sega's products. And as with most Pong and Pong-related clones, Pong did incredibly well for Sega, so much so that they explored the new video game trend more. The next year, Sega would put out Pong Tron 2 and another follow-up called Hockey TV.
So, but the Pong, that only lasts for so long, you know. Once people get tired of Pong, you've got to come up with something else. So, but that was like enough for them to say like, okay, this is big. This is not just something that's going to fizzle out. This is here to stay. So now we have to come up with more.
And that's exactly what Sega did. They continued to explore this emerging market and would license and distribute other companies' games as well as innovate their own games. Sega continued developing and licensing arcade video games in Japan and distributing them overseas. But just like with the electromechanical coin-op machines, all the international shipping proved to be a challenge. So it was time for Sega to develop and manufacture games in the US for the American market. And to get a jump on the American arcade market, Sega purchased the up-and-coming company Gremlin. No, not that Gremlin. And this collaboration is what led Sega to become a leader in the arcade industry. In 1979, the Gremlin Sega of America team developed a game called Head On, a two-player game where players would drive through a maze collecting dots and avoiding collisions.
The thing about Head On is that Head On, which was developed in 1979, it's influential because it's the first of what Sega called the multi-phase games, which were basically that adapted and becomes more difficult as players get better.
Head On was a major influence in the arcade world, which eventually influenced games like Pac-Man.
It was, you know, the first eat the dots type game. You know, Pac-Man is the most famous and I'd say the most influential because of the fame that Pac-Man had and you know, the phenomenon that it was.
More and more hit games would come from Sega of America's team. And in 1981, Sega and Gremlin licensed and manufactured an arcade game from Konami called Frogger. Sega's arcade business was booming, but Sega saw another business opportunity. You see, in the late 70s, Sega saw an opportunity to buy out one of its competitors, Atari. You see, allegedly Sega was in talks with Atari's founder, Nolan Bushnell, to purchase the company. The deal was close to being finalized, but at the last minute, Bushnell received a phone call that explained that the company's engineers at Atari had come up with a single device that could play multiple arcade games. With this invention on hand, Bushnell decided to cancel the deal with Sega, and that device would later go on to become the Atari 2600. And just like that, the video game console market was born. We're going to take a quick break here, but when we come back, the Wild West of the console industry. Welcome back.
So you're telling me that Sega was a wartime company that eventually kind of like captured the essence of a post-war culture in Japan and really kind of capitalized on it.
Absolutely. And it's crazy to me that it was a father and son business and that's how it started. And then they've essentially just been creating video games and the things that led up to video games before that was even remotely possible, you know, way back when.
Right. And that's wild to me that they were, well, David Rosen was in the imaging for IDs. Like that is, it's wild to me how much history there is here.
Definitely. So we've covered about 50 years of total history throughout this whole thing leading up to right before the consoles.
But as far as we go, what we know about Sega, it really, that's not what they're known for, right?
Right. So Sega's renown, like what Sega is known for, really comes down to this tiny 17-year period and their long, like 90-year history.
I cannot believe you're going to cover all of that in the second half of this show.
Well, we might not get into all of that, but at any rate,
let's go.
No, that. In the late 70s and early 80s, video games started moving away from the arcade and started moving to the living room TV. Atari found massive success with their console through the 70s, and soon many other companies jumped in on this new hot trend. Soon, the market was flooded with consoles from different companies, from the Atari Video Computer System, the Atari 2600, to the Intellivision, to the Magnavox Odyssey, to the ColecoVision. The home video game market gave consumers a wealth of options. Options were great, but the one downside, though? A varying degree of quality in both games and in consoles. And it was that disparity in quality, along with the oversaturated marketplace, that led to the video game crash of 1983. The industry suddenly went from this $3 billion industry in 1983 and dropped almost 97% to a much lower $100 million by 1985. The American market is where things were hit the hardest, and the whole crash is best depicted by Atari's E.T. game, which was so bad that they had to take the entire inventory of it and dump it in a landfill. But a little late to the party, two successful arcade companies tested the consumer video game market despite the recession. On the same day, in July of 1983, Sega released the SG-1000, and Nintendo released the Famicom. Both of these companies released these consoles, and they were positioned well to bring their popular arcade games to the family room TV. But Nintendo had a leg up.
Well, Nintendo had already been releasing home game machines with its colored TV game, which were, it had Pong clones and things like that. So it had already had a presence in the home video game market that there was at that time. And by 1983, they had already released the Game & Watch, I think 79 or 78. So the Famicom was the latest of a series of consumer products that Nintendo was pushing. Nintendo was moving into that market before the Famicom even came out.
Armed with experience to effectively sell consumer electronics, Nintendo's Famicom was a huge success in Japan, later coming to the rest of the world in 1985 as the Nintendo Entertainment System, and Nintendo's success could not have been better timed. The video game crash had wiped out the competition, leaving the goal wide open for Nintendo. Sega, on the other hand, really failed to find success with the SG-1000 in Japan, and it wasn't due to the quality of games. Sega was able to port many of its popular arcade titles to the system, as well as develop new exciting titles. Sega simply just didn't know how to market in the consumer electronics space and didn't invest the money to push it further.
They didn't have the focus on becoming a consumer product company the way Nintendo did, because Sega was, you know, Nakayama and others, these were hardware guys, these were coin-op guys, and Sega was primarily a coin-op company.
The SG-1000 failed to make a splash, but Sega's research team continued to explore this technology. After a few iterations, Sega released the 8-bit Master System in 1985 in Japan. And a year later, internationally. And the Master System was a major improvement over its previous consoles, with better technology than even the Famicom or the NES. The problem was, they were a few years late to the market. Even more problematic, Sega really had no branch at all in America after previously pulling out of the country due to the crash. Sega faced numerous challenges, but if they were to find success with the home console market, it was imperative that they have a presence in the United States. Starting from scratch in America wasn't going to be easy. Fortunately, Sega's president and CEO, Hayao Nakayama, was a bulldog and one that was willing to do whatever it took to succeed. Although he was born and raised in Japan, Nakayama was not only fluent in English, but very comfortable speaking the language. He had done a good amount of business with American companies, and in a lot of ways, he strove to run Sega with a lot of the same practices as American companies. Now, Nakayama knew that the only way to get Sega's console business going was a strategic hire. He would target not just a person familiar with the video game industry, he would hire straight from the competition. Nakayama went straight after Nintendo of America's vice president of sales, Bruce Lowry.
Bruce Lowry was kind of a risk taker. I think that's the reason why the Master System ended up being what it was.
Before joining Sega of America, Bruce Lowry helped to launch the NES in America, and he was there at the huge launch event in New York City, and he was one of the key people that helped to organize and ensure that launch was a success. And when Nakayama came knocking on Lowry's door to offer to run Sega's America's business arm and launch their new product, he was conflicted. Bruce Lowry was really happy at Nintendo of America. Lowry enjoyed the challenge of launching a new console in America, and he knew what it took, and he was tempted to make that whole thing happen again. So he did. Lowry took the job, and in 1986, he began building the business in America. And the first thing he did was come up with a name, and Nintendo of America worked really well, so he went with Sega of America. Once he had the name, he had to get some employees, because there weren't any at all. There was literally only Bruce Lowry. So Lowry built it from the ground up.
And Lowry got the Master System into stores, just about all the major retailers, had it launched with a good software library. It came with two controls. It came with a gun, the packaging and everything. That was all under his watch.
As if that wasn't hard enough, Sega of Japan had a lofty goal of selling 1 million units of the Master System in the US. And to make it happen, Sega of Japan decided to partner with the toy company Tonka. Tonka had the resources to market and distribute the Master System, but the problem was Tonka had virtually no experience at all with consumer electronics and did not know how to market video games.
Sega challenges you with the ultimate video game. The Sega Master System, with twice as much memory as any other video game. Sega Master System. The challenge will always be there.
Lowry was super frustrated with this decision. He had just hired over a dozen employees strategically, and he was geared up to do all of this himself. Now Tonka would make all of the marketing and distribution decisions while he was reduced to managing incoming products from Japan. Despite everyone's best efforts, Sega only managed to sell about 500,000 units of the Master System across 3 years in the US and could only grab about 5% of the market share away from Nintendo. Now, it really wasn't all Sega's fault because Nintendo's success was super unprecedented. Not only was Nintendo selling more than 5 million units every single year of the NES, they managed to get the NES in 30% of every single home in America by 1990. Was your home one of them? Convincing the public to buy a similar, less popular system that could not play Mario or Zelda, that was really not an easy task to do. But Sega continued to do what they did best, and that was innovate. And the engineering team at Sega was ahead of the competition. By 1988, Sega was ready to debut their brand new 16-bit console. Sega! In October of 1988, Sega released the Mega Drive in Japan. Unfortunately for Sega, when it came to the American market, the name Mega Drive was actually already taken by a computer chip manufacturer. So Sega had to come up with a brand new name for this console.
There was like this competition to pick the name. And there were different names. I think like Cyclone was one name. And the name that won out was Genesis. Some people say it was like because of the Star Trek II, which had come out a couple of years earlier.
Computer, request security procedure. And access to Project Genesis summary.
Security scan approved.
Summary, please.
Project Genesis, a proposal to the Federation. What exactly is Genesis? Well, put simply, Genesis is life from lifelessness.
The name makes sense, right? I mean, because it's supposed to be a new start, a rebirth, right?
So whether it was named after a new beginning or from that thing from Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan?
It literally is Genesis.
Yes, well said, Spock. Another possible theory for the origin of the name of this console could have been from... Whoa, cool your jets, Phil Collins. Probably not that. At any rate, in 1989, Sega released the Genesis in America. But unfortunately, ahead of the Genesis's launch, Bruce Lowry decided to part ways with Sega. And this was most likely due to Sega of Japan electing Tonka over Bruce Lowry's decision to do it himself. And Sega elected a new leader of Sega of America, one that was really qualified, Michael Katz.
Well, Michael Katz he's kind of a maverick. He'd been in the American computer and game industry for years. And he had a really, really good understanding of, or considered himself to have a good understanding of the market.
With both experience at Atari, as well as high-level experience with the toy company Mattel, Michael Katz was definitely well-suited for the job. He was tasked with ensuring the Genesis was a success in America. Fortunately for Katz, the Genesis was a much more powerful machine than the NES, capable of 16-bit graphics. Sega could bring over many more of their popular arcade titles to the new console, including Golden Axe, Revenge of Shinobi, and it was bundled with the title Altered Beasts. And using what Bruce Lowry built as a baseline, Katz was able to lead the team at Sega of America to establish a relationship with retailers and, more importantly, ensuring that the Genesis had great games that would appeal to the American market. So getting third-party developers to make games for the Genesis was key for Sega's success, especially in the American market, but it had been a major struggle up to that point due to Nintendo's ironclad grip on the industry. You see, back in the 80s,
This is a song from the 80s. The decade which it currently is.
After the crash, Nintendo had to make sure that there was a viable industry. And the only way to do that was to control the entire video game market, which meant ensuring quality in their own products, but also controlling third-party developers and controlling retailers. If you were a company making video games and you wanted to make a game for Nintendo, Nintendo had a few rules for you.
Your company makes games for the NES. It can only release a certain amount of games per year, right? If you want to release for competing consoles, you can, but there has to be, I think, a two-year gap between when it's released for the NES and when it comes out for the other consoles. So technically, you can do it, right? But the attitude was, well, yeah, you can go and release that game for the Sega Master System, but it would be a shame if the allotment of chips that you had for, you know, the game that you're going to release in Christmas, you know, which is a really important season, be a shame if that allotment of chips went to, I don't know, this other company instead. There was no way in 1990, 89, 90, and even 91, that a publisher could say no to Nintendo because it was just too big and the market was just... There was just too much money on the table.
With Nintendo holding up the majority of third-party developers, Michael Katz had to establish close partnerships with a few remaining developers. Michael Katz was able to create a solid partnership with EA to develop leading sports games for the Sega Genesis, as well as other small development teams.
The thing is, if Michael Katz hadn't done that, you probably wouldn't have seen Sega build its Sega Sports brand the way it did. And, you know, at its height, the Sega Sports brand accounted for about 43% of Sega of America's revenue. So in the United States, sports are incredibly important. And he saw that. He was the first one to recognize that.
So Sega had the more powerful console with the Genesis compared to the NES and had a stream of great exclusive games that was really the only place for sports video games. Now, the trick was convincing the public. And to fix this, the first thing that Michael Katz did was go and license some of the biggest celebrities of the time. He somehow managed to have Michael Jackson's likeness in a game called Michael Jackson's Moonwalker with the excited support of the pop star, and he also grabbed Joe Montana for Joe Montana Football. The next step was telling the public with TV ads, and for this, Katz decided to go directly after the competition. This sort of practice was generally really against Japanese culture, but Sega was left with little choice. And what they came up with was an aggressive ad campaign that not only mentioned the competition, but touted their superiority.
Genesis does 16-bit arcade graphics.
You can't do this on Nintendo. Genesis does
16-bit sports action.
You can't do this on Nintendo. Genesis
does.
Genesis
does.
Genesis
does.
Genesis
does.
Genesis does.
Get Joe Montana free, Pat Riley free, Buster Douglas free, Super Monaco GP free, or Collins free. What Nintendo don't.
Though maybe a little on the nose, Sega was getting their point across in a way that could stick in your head. The Genesis
does.
The Sega Genesis
does.
The Genesis
does.
All right, how do I turn off these clips? The 16-bit console
does.
Okay, I didn't even say it that time. Anyways, Sega's product was starting to garner attention, and little by little, they were chipping away at Nintendo's market share. But there was a major problem looming on the horizon. Nintendo's 16-bit console, the Super Famicom, or the Super Nintendo, which was slated to release very soon. And with the ability to lean on popular IPs like Mario and Zelda, Sega could soon be crushed despite their recent success. Anxious about the looming threat, Hayao Nakayama pushed to ensure Sega of America's success. And to do this, Nakayama called on the best in the business, Tom Kalinske, the man responsible for not only making Mattel the leading toy company, but creating and reinventing the most popular toy brands of all time. In fact, you might not know the name, but Tom Kalinske had a major influence on 70s and 80s pop culture at large, and he's probably influenced your life in some way. Among other things, he was responsible for creating a popular action figure for boys, and he promoted it with a hit TV show.
And the Masters of the Universe!
That's right. He-Man was Tom Kalinske's idea, and he did a lot more too. He reinvented the Barbie line, making that super popular. He made Hot Wheels the big toy brand. He revitalized Matchbox cars, and oddly enough, before getting into the toy industry, he's the one that came up with the idea for putting Flintstones characters on vitamins.
And just one Flintstone a day has all the vitamins kids normally need to take when they don't eat right.
Flintstone vitamins. Oh, great idea, Fred.
Yeah, Flintstones vitamins was Tom Kalinske's idea. Everything Kalinske touched seemed to turn to gold. Despite the current president of Sega of America, Michael Katz, doing a really great job, Nakayama wanted more. He wanted gold. He wanted Tom Kalinske to run Sega of America. So Nakayama tracked down Tom Kalinske and brought him on board. No, really, he tracked him down. Kalinske was in retirement at the time, and he was not returning any phone calls. So when Nakayama found out that he was going on vacation with his family in Hawaii, he found out where Kalinske was staying, jumped on an airplane, and approached him down on the beach. With a short trip to Japan and promises of running things how he wanted, Kalinske was very interested. He had never dealt ever with video games before, or even consumer electronics in general. He was quick to admit his shortcomings, but also a bit excited about the challenge. At first, Kalinske didn't even realize he'd be running the show at Sega of America. He thought he was brought on as an advisor. It turns out, though, Michael Katz was thrown right out, and Tom Kalinske was in. Kalinske had a lot to learn about the industry in a very short period of time, but Kalinske was no dummy. He was a very quick study, and he was even better when it came to people.
Honestly, he's the kind of guy you want to have a beer with. I mean, he didn't come across as arrogant. His answers, the way he talks, he's just very, very humble and very, very down to earth, very approachable, you know?
After a few short months, Kalinske was able to get to know Sega of America's team and get a solid understanding of the video game industry and Sega's current place in it. With the benefit of an outside perspective and a knack for creating very well-known brands, Kalinske knew exactly what Sega was missing. A mascot. He didn't need to understand video games to take one look at the competition and understand the value of Mario. Sega needed a Mario, and they needed it desperately. And Sega was aware of this too, so in the late 80s, Sega had an internal competition to see who could come up with a mascot character for Sega, one that could really be focused on the American market. And the competition was, well, a competition. You see, the runner-up was an egg character. But the winner was a hedgehog called Mr. Needlemouse. Recent rumors suggest that this well-known piece of Sega history is actually a translation error, and the original name was simply Mr. Hedgehog, but regardless, it would later be known as Sonic the Hedgehog. Now, nobody knew the importance of Sonic the Hedgehog more than Kalinske, but as soon as he heard about the soon-to-be mascot, he had a particular question.
What's a hedgehog?
It isn't exactly a well-known species in America. According to the book Console Wars, Sega of America faxed over an early sketch of Sonic the Hedgehog, and Kalinske and the Sega of America team, well, they weren't exactly thrilled. Sonic had pointy fangs, a spiked collar, an electric guitar, and a human girlfriend.
Who's the girl?
Kalinske was finally able to ask when he was prompted by Nakayama on what he thought of the sketch. And Nakayama simply said, oh, that's Madonna.
Of course it is.
Needless to say, some things needed to change. And the change would come later, but first Kalinske had to fly to Japan and tell the board of directors his plan for Sega of America. So Tom Kalinske jumped on an airplane and flew to Sega's headquarters in Japan, armed with a plan and a presentation.
Konnichiwa. Hey, I just want to thank you all for your time. It's very nice to meet you all. When Nakayama-san brought me onto the Sega of America team, he asked me to give my full assessment of Sega of America and how it was doing in the video game market. He also asked that once I get a full lay of the land, to give my best recommendation on how to make the Genesis a success in America. Well, after 3 months of observation, careful studying of the market, getting to know this great company through and through, and learning the video game industry and Sega's important place in it, I am happy to provide my best recommendations for success. You know, actually, not just success, domination. We can topple the big N, and this is how to do it. All right, I know. I'm new to the industry, but I can assure you, after nearly two decades in the toy industry, I know exactly what it takes to make a premium product fly off the store shelves. All right, let's get this started. I'll make this short and sweet. Which button do I press? I did this before. Oh, boy, none of these are working. Got it. Okay, so here's what I propose we do in America. Step one, we reduce the cost of the Genesis from $189 down to $150. We need to price it lower than the competition. And to me, $150 feels like a nice, round, friendly, affordable number, right? Sure, this cuts into profits, but we have to get the console into the hands of the consumer so that they will buy games. Lots of games. All the kids love Space Harrier. We need to get it to them. Step two, refocus the marketing. The current ads, Sega does what Nintendo don't, they're fine. I thought they were clever. They're fine, but it needs to be sharper. It's simple. We want the Genesis to be the coolest thing to have. It's not your run-of-the-mill, bland, gray video console. It's sleek. It's cutting edge. It's new. It's the best of the best. It's Sega, baby. We have to make that clear in our marketing. Step three, we change the pack-in game from that hit arcade game Altered Beast to a different game. Altered Beast is a great game. Great game, no doubt. But the name Altered Beast, that name is never going to sell in a place like Kansas. It's got a demonic tone that's sure to turn off nice Midwestern folks. Okay, I say we put our best foot forward and bundle in the hottest new game with the console. Not just any game, but a game with an iconic character. Character you associate with the Sega brand. You can see right on the box. I am suggesting that we make the pack-in game Sonic the Hedgehog. Let's make the console as appealing as possible and get the gamer invested. That way, after you purchase, they will buy many more games. And that's it. We make the console more affordable, slap an iconic character on the box, pack in the must-have game, Sonic the Hedgehog, and strategically market it. The Genesis is going to fly off of store shelves if we do this. And that's it. That's it. It's just that simple. Pretty simple, right? Any questions? Anybody? Not seeing a lot of hands. That's cool. Anybody? You? No? Okay.
After a few minutes of awkward silence, the room exploded in conversation. Of course, it was all in Japanese, so Kalinske didn't really know what was going on. But finally, after a long while, Nakayama quieted everyone down, turned to Kalinske, and simply said, everyone here hates your ideas. You see, they knew that lowering the console's price would severely cut into the company's margins. They certainly didn't want to spend more money on an already overinflated marketing budget, and well, why in the world would they give away their baby Sonic the Hedgehog, which was shaping up to be the best game on the system? Why would they give that away for free? Well, Kalinske, well, he thought he was going to be fired right there on the spot.
Well, I guess this is going to be the shortest career move ever.
So Kalinske tucked his tail between his legs, started walking out of the room, but at the last minute, Nakayama gave him full permission to carry out his ideas the way he wanted to. He hired him to do a job, and you know what? He was going to let him do it. Let's take another quick break here. Hello, travelers of the digital age. If you're enjoying Level Zero, I wanted to tell you about another podcast that you might want to check out. It's our sister podcast called Draft Punks.
Draft Punks is a show where three friends get together with a special guest each week.
Right, and they choose a topic that the guest loves, and they do a fantasy-style draft of things from that topic.
It's a cool format to have fun, in-depth discussions on random things.
They'll basically cover anything and everything from MCU films
to video game levels
to their favorite one-hit wonders. And sometimes you and me are the guests on that show.
We definitely are.
And Preston, you also host a separate show on the Draft Punks podcast feed.
I do. It's a podcast game show called Trivia Punks, where Brian and I get a new guest on each month and quiz them on what they claim to be an expert on.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun, and it's all there on the same Draft Punks feed. So if you're interested, you can find and subscribe to Draft Punks on all the same podcast services that Level Zero is available on.
And if you visit them on Twitter at @RealDraftPunks, you can join their Discord, the official home of both Draft Punks as well as our own Level Zero podcast community.
We hope you check it out.
Thank you.
Welcome back. So Sega of Japan's CEO, Hayao Nakayama, gave Tom Kalinske full permission to do exactly what he wanted. And just like that, Sega of America was off to the races. Kalinske began to get to know his team and soon found out that there were some very talented and dedicated folks on board. Al Nilsson, Sega of America's head of marketing, as well as vice president Shinobu Toyoda. They worked closely with Kalinske and helped to steer the ship in the right direction.
He always emphasized that it was a team effort and it was a team of people. You know,
if you look at it today, it's difficult to think of Sega without picturing Sonic the Hedgehog. And the big reason for that is Tom Kalinske. He worked with his team at Sega of America to turn Sonic's image into something a little less punk rock and a little more appealing to American audiences. It was a concerted effort, and Sega of Japan actually ended up fighting back on most of the suggested changes. But Kalinske and the team were able to make small tweaks and compromises until they could get Sonic's character design to the point where everyone was happy. And when Sonic the Hedgehog released in June of 1991, it was an amazing sight to see. With incredibly fast movement, vibrant colors, and an attitude very different from any game that came before it. And you know what? It feels wrong to talk about Sonic the Hedgehog without actually talking to the source. So let me just try calling him one more time. I'm just going to ring him here because, at the end of the day, who's going to know better to talk about this than him, right? He's the best, so. Oh, come on. I hope he picks up.
Hi, reached Sonic. Shoot. I'm the fastest, but I somehow missed your call. Leave me a message and I'll get back to you speedy quick. Juice and jam time.
Shoot. All right, well, we'll do it without him. Sales for the Genesis skyrocketed. Folks that had already bought a Genesis quickly bought the game, and people unsure about the Genesis suddenly became interested in it when the price dropped and that game was included. And within a short period of time, Tom Kalinske's plan was working. And Kalinske and the team had no plans to sit back and soak in the success. They springboarded off the popularity of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Come on, just show me what you got. Going fast is cool, going slow is not.
This was all excellent timing for Sega because Nintendo's 16-bit console, the Super Nintendo, was slated to release in September of that very year. The Super Nintendo would be $199 and the pack-in game would be Super Mario World.
Introducing the next generation from Nintendo, New Super Mario World, created especially for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. It's a bit more exciting, a bit more challenging, a bit more graphic, a bit more colorful, a bit more realistic, a bit more levels, a bit more secrets, a bit more enemies, a bit more friends, a bit more sound, a bit hotter, a bit cooler, a bit weird, a bit more revolutionary, a bit more Mario, a bit more of what you want. It's 16-bit, and it's yours only if you get New Super Nintendo. Now you're playing with power, superpower.
Of course, with the vast majority control of the market share, Nintendo was not exactly worried about their competition. The Super Nintendo would be the hot new item, and fans were excited for it. And when Sega got its hands on the game, Sega happily pushed comparisons of Super Mario World to Sonic the Hedgehog, boasting the speed and innovation of Sonic, running side-by-side comparisons at their E3 booth, and even running direct TV ads comparing the two games.
Gotta go.
Hey, guy, you're the first serious gamer I've seen all morning. Check this out. Brand new 16-bit Super Nintendo with Super Mario World. Wow!
What's this one?
Oh, this is a Sonic the Hedgehog from Sega Genesis. Hey, look at these radical colors, huh?
Wow, Sonic's fast, too.
No, over here.
I like Genesis, and it costs a lot less.
Wait, kid, that game
I'll take Sonic and Genesis.
I knew that.
Sonic the Hedgehog. More action, more speed. Sega Genesis, it's a whole lot more for less.
Although Super Mario World stands tall as a great Mario game, at the time, Super Mario World was very similar to Super Mario 3, whereas Sonic the Hedgehog was flashy, edgy, and brand new. In fact, Sega did several anonymous surveys quizzing various consumers on what they thought of the two games and which of the two they preferred after a brief demo, and the majority preferred Sonic. The Super Nintendo released on September 9th, 1991, and to no one's surprise, it sold very well. But the Sega of America team continued to hustle. The team pushed that the Sega Genesis was cheaper, it had a more interesting, innovative pack-in game, and it had also been out for almost 3 years, meaning the available game library was much, much bigger on the Genesis. Not only that, but you could buy an adapter to allow people to play Master System games on the Genesis, which was something you could not do with the Super Nintendo. Tom Kalinske and the team did their best to make all these points clear to the public through their advertising campaigns. And they pushed and pushed to get brand new commercials. They even utilized the same advertising company that did the Just Do It commercials for Nike. What they finally came up with for advertising Sega was wild.
Welcome to the Next Lava!
Besides having a super chaotic, flashing, extremely fast commercial, they also had someone screaming Sega at your face in a way that somehow was not annoying.
Sega!
Okay, maybe it was a little bit annoying, but at any rate, it's still stuck in your brain. And all of this was working. For the first time, Nintendo did not have the best-selling consumer electronics of the holiday season. In 1991, the Sega Genesis outsold the Super Nintendo. The mighty Nintendo was starting to topple. Thanks in large part to the work that Bruce Lowry and Michael Katz had done in securing America's game developers, Sega of America was able to keep a steady flow of great exclusive games coming to the Genesis. Nintendo was starting to lose its iron grip, and soon, third-party game development opportunities started to come. Whereas before, Nintendo could not allow developers to create games for Nintendo systems and other companies' hardware, now they could. For example, Mortal Kombat came out for the Sega Genesis and the Super Nintendo on the same day, and this had never been heard of before. And likely in fear of being sued for monopolistic practices, Nintendo allowed for this to happen.
They snap their fingers and say, oh, you know what, if you want to make games for other consoles, go right ahead. And Capcom and Konami, boom, and other companies flood the Genesis with titles. And that's where they, from then on, is when you see that the Genesis becomes a contender and cracks that monopoly.
Now, when a hit third-party game was made, it could be released on both a Nintendo system and a Sega system. So after the huge release of Sonic the Hedgehog, it's no surprise that a sequel was in high demand. This time around, Yuji Naka, the creator of the original, would make the sequel in America under a special team called the Sega Technology Institute, led none other by a man named Mark Cerny, who you may know as the creator of the PS4 and the PS5. The Sega Technology Institute was responsible for researching and pushing new innovations in games. And Sonic 2 was set to release in 1992, which really gave this development team barely over 1 year to make the sequel to the best-selling game of the previous year. Could they pull off another hit in that short period of time? It was a bit of a risk, but the Sega of America team decided to put all of their eggs in the Sonic 2 basket. The team was eager to keep the momentum going, and they were willing to try anything new to compete with the giant that was Nintendo. So the Sega of America team came up with a new idea, a global launch event for a video game release. What if Sonic 2 released on the same day at every store around the world? While this sounds like a very normal thing by today's standards, back in the early 90s, video games didn't actually have a release day. It was more like a release window. You see, the games, when they were finished, they would be packaged, then they went out for delivery on the trucks, and whenever the retailers received them, that's when the games went up onto store shelves. But for Sonic 2, it would be a day to remember. It would be called Sonic Tuesday. You know, like the number two for Tuesday. The Sega team coordinated with every single retailer and distributor around the globe to make sure they received copies of the game in advance and would not sell them until Sonic Tuesday. Not only that, but they had a $10 million marketing budget for Sonic 2 alone, which included not only commercials, but teen star celebrity endorsements from the likes of Jonathan Taylor Thomas of Home Improvement fame.
Yeah, you know, Sonic 2 is great. It's better than the first one. You have great graphics. Sonic has a new friend called Tails the Fox, Two Tails. Cool.
And Samuel Powers, Screech from Saved by the Bell.
It is a total race, run, just have a blast, fun type of game.
And if you thought the first one was good, where do you see the second one?
And this all sure would have been really embarrassing if the game had turned out to be bad. Fortunately for Sega, the development team was able to take what was great about the first Sonic game and expand on it to create what many consider one of the very best platformers ever made. Spin dashes, the inclusion of Tails, brand new worlds, a two-player mode. Sonic 2 had it all. And on Sonic Tuesday, November 24th of 1992, Sonic the Hedgehog 2 released and broke every single video game sales record that there ever was. All 3.2 million copies of the game that were made for the initial release were all sold out in just 2 weeks. It would go on to be the second best-selling Genesis game, just behind the first Sonic game, of course. Whether it was due to the huge marketing budget, the celebrity endorsements, or the unarguable quality of the game, the video game release day idea was proven on Sonic Tuesday. With the booming popularity of Sonic, along with a large library of diverse games, the Sega Genesis was in high demand. Within just a few short years of Tom Kalinske joining Sega of America, the mighty Nintendo lost its majority hold on the video game industry. Sega became the market leader, holding nearly 60% market share in the United States alone. There were now two giants. It still lagged behind in other countries, but still, Sega allowed for real competition in the global gaming industry. From the humble beginnings of a small American father and son business in the 1930s and 40s, who would buy simple coin-operated machines and sell them to entertain American servicemen during World War II, to a post-war company who would find opportunity selling and maintaining various coin-operated machines in Japan, to a leading Japanese electromechanical and arcade development company, to a struggling consumer electronic console business who was far, far behind the competition, to a scrappy underdog who did whatever it took to gain a foothold in the monopoly of a marketplace, to America's leading video game company. Thanks to Tom Kalinske, the team at Sega of America, and a little bit of help from our friend Sonic the Hedgehog, by 1994, Sega was on top of the video game world.
So Sega went from a 5% market share to a 60% market share in only 5 years?
Right. Well, in the United States at any rate, but basically the mid-80s and the mid-90s was just a really crazy time for consumer electronics. Everything was moving very, very fast.
It was. So like the Game Gear, right?
Shoot. Did I not talk about the Game Gear?
You're going to have to talk about the Game Gear.
Okay, so let me just talk about that real quick. So the Game Gear was basically Sega's response to, you know, Nintendo's Game Boy, except...
Right. And so, but what was the Sega Channel, actually?
I didn't talk about the Sega Channel either. So the Sega Channel was basically a way that Sega was able to try to plug into, like, broadband cable and stream people games.
But then they came out with the Dreamcast right after that, right?
Okay, hold on. We're going to cover all of these things in detail in part two. We'll just cover those things in part two.
Okay. Well, and it's so cool that you had Ken Horowitz come out and give you sort of like to back up a lot of the research. And I'm excited to hear more from him in part two.
Absolutely. A special thanks to Ken Horowitz. If you yourself, the listener, want to know more about Sega's history, I definitely recommend checking out Ken Horowitz's books. He's written 3 books now. Two of them that are on Sega are Playing at the Next Level and the Sega Arcade Revolution. And they're basically like textbooks, but for video game history.
Yeah. And he does a really good job of keeping it interesting. But mm-hmm. A lot of this is based around his website, right?
Right. So his website that he runs is sega-16.com. There's a little hyphen in there, sega16.com. And there's just so much Sega history just jam-packed into that website.
And he also has like crazy interviews in there.
Right, where he's the one actually interviewing people like I talked about, like Tom Kalinske, like Michael Katz. He interviewed those people.
That is so incredibly cool.
And he basically transcribed all of those interviews and put them there on the website. And not only is that on the website, but there's also modern reviews of old classic Sega titles, which I think is a pretty cool thing for a video game website to do.
Yeah, I really like that idea. That's really cool.
Also, special thanks to our friend of the show and Tom Kalinske impersonator, Bob Buell. Mm-hmm. Bob is the host of one of my very favorite podcasts, 99 Questions. Mm. There will be a link to that down in the show notes. Thank you so, so much for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Sharing by word of mouth is the very, very best way to grow the show.
Yeah. And additionally, if you really like it, go on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. That helps a lot, tremendously too.
So if you bear with us for just a few minutes, there's a couple of quick announcements because we mm-hmm. did just launch season two, and there's a couple of other exciting things too. Right, Preston?
Yes. There are a bunch of exciting things. I think one thing we should talk about real quick is, when can people expect episodes?
Right. So no matter what, at a minimum, you're always going to get at least one brand new episode in your podcast feed every single month.
Yes. And additionally, some of them might be might be two-parters.
Right.
And hopefully we'll also be having little bonus levels, which are going to be additional episodes that are in relation to the topic of the month, but not right. necessarily just expansions on the same episode that we've already had.
Right. And bonus levels will come and go. Sometimes they'll be there, sometimes they won't. And they'll always be a little bit different format than kind of the standard level zero scripted format.
Right. They may be conversations. They may be just quick snippets. We're not entirely sure what they're going to look like, but it should be more level zero, which is exciting.
Exactly. But we're more than just a podcast now, aren't we?
Yes. We have a Twitch channel. Twitch.tv/level0pod.
Right. And on that Twitch channel, there is now a weekly show where you are talking to indie developers about their indie games or with fans of those indie games and talking all about the development of those games.
Yeah, that one is going to be every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Central. We talk, like you said, to indie developers or fans of indie games about indie games in detail. And so the show is going to be called Indie Tale.
And gotcha.
I am really, really pumped about it. We've already done, at this point, 6 episodes. I've gotten to talk to Charles McGregor. I've talked to Rich McLaughlin about OppaSwitch.
Right. And so if you miss the stream on Wednesday, you can also jump over to another new thing, which is our YouTube channel.
Right. So any episodes that you may miss is on the YouTube channel, which we're also doing some other things there, like show clips with video and also the occasional game review.
Absolutely. So all those fun new things. You've got the Level Zero podcast, you've got the Level Zero Twitch stream, and you've got the YouTube channel, all of those at Level Zero Pod. Mm-hmm. But Preston, if you wanted to support the show, you like what you hear here, you want to support it maybe financially, what's the very best way to do that?
So for now, I think the best way to do it is going to be through a Twitch sub. So if you go on Twitch, give us a subscription, subscribe to the channel, I mean, then right. that would really help a lot.
And if you have Amazon Prime membership, you just get a free one of those. So if you want to just toss that free sub over to us, that would be amazing. You'd be helping support the show and help us to make more episodes.
Yes. And I should be ramping up some more Twitch streams here soon. So that way you'll get more for your money as well.
So if you wanted to discuss the show, talk to us, connect with us, the best way, there's a couple of cool ways to do that. You can do that on Twitter at Level Zero Pod. Mm-hmm. You can also do that on email, questions@levelzeropod.com. Or what's another way that we can talk as a community?
Well, recently we joined the Draft Punks Discord.
Right.
Hooray. and so we're very excited about that. We have our own little section within their server. And so you can join the server. It is linked down below. And come and talk to us about any of our shows, whether it's the Sega episode, Indie Tale, or whatever we've got coming up.
Absolutely. And also, this very episode, there's a transcript that you can find in the show notes. That's a link from our website where you can actually listen on the browser and you could read this as an article if you wanted to.
There are so many things in the show notes, so many links.
That's right. All of the different things. The thing with Ken Horowitz, his books, all of the things that we just discussed from Twitch to YouTube, Indie Tale, all of those things are down in the show notes that you can look at.
Right. And thank y'all for listening to all of this rambling at the end, as well as the incredible amount of research and conversation with Ken Horowitz that Greg was able to get in.
And there's more on the next episode, The Fall of Sega.
Scary, scary.
Right. So make sure that you are following this podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever. So when that episode drops, you see it right away.
Mm-hmm. And as we always say at the end of our episodes, let's go.
No, Preston, we don't say let's go. Let me just do it here. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Let's go.
Dang it, Preston.
come to the phone right now. Maybe I am off doing something else, but please leave me a message and I'll get back to you. Thank you.
Hi. This is Sonic the Hedgehog. You left me like 14 messages, so I'm just trying to make that stop. I guess call me back. And this time, maybe not in the middle of the night. And also, please stop leaving voicemails. Okay, bye!